The night before I covered my first Federal Reserve meeting, I cried. Because, honestly, explaining the Fed can be hard. It's so important to what people do every day, but it can seem impenetrable. Until you realize that, in the old metaphor, it's like gas and brakes for the economy. A little more money out there, a little less, give and take. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. And yes, I know that what the Fed does is more complex these days than simple give and take of the money supply. But that thread of give and take is in all our stories this week. Interest rates and money, sure, but also how we make refugee policy. And, well, literal gifts and your hilarious stories about them. And we always want some give and take from you. Go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're going to start the show with some literal give and take stories from you about the worst gifts you've ever given or gotten. We put this question out on Facebook, and honestly, I laughed so hard at your answers that people came into my office to check on me. So here you go.
By far, the worst gift I have ever received for Christmas is an electric quesadilla maker. It is still a mystery to me why this is for sale, considering how easy it is just to put a tortilla in a pan. My face showed it all when I opened the gift, I'm certain.
I'm Jewish, and my first Christmas was the year that I married my now ex-husband, who is not Jewish. The gift I received was a hand-painted ceramic bell Christmas ornament, which had been personalized with both of our names. But it probably would have worked out a little bit better if they had just spared the time and expense and asked first if we had a Christmas tree in our home, which we do not. I think I still have it packed away somewhere in its original box. Since it was personalized, I couldn't re-gift it, but since it really was a very nice gesture, I couldn't bring myself to throw it out.
I mounted a pheasant for my oldest brother back when I was in high school, and the bird was positioned to look like it had just been startled and was flying into the sky out of a field. Well, he seemed to like it, but I now wonder if there was a conspiracy in my family to humor me.
It was this turquoise rock with a heart cut into it and painted gold. And then I had also received a cat that was dressed like a fairy princess or something. And we had only been together for a little over a month and a half, so he didn't know my tastes very well at the time and was getting advice from his mother on what he should get me. I still have it. We joke about, you know, can we get each other? Well, I can get you a rock with a heart in it if you really want.
The worst gift I've ever received for Christmas came from my mom. What I would say was probably about a 5-foot body pillow shaped like a largemouth bass and printed like a largemouth bass. And I'm afraid of fish, so I don't know if she thought it was a joke or what. I still to this day have not told her that I threw it away. I'm only hoping that she forgot I ever had it in the first place.
Thanks to Matthew Oliver, Regina Gelzer, Alex Hurd, Jen Dolny, and Jeremy Negre. And then there was one story on Facebook that I just had to ask more about. Sarah Hull wrote about gifts from her grandmother, and I'm going to let her explain.
I think she might have just been over the whole gift-giving thing. She was probably in her late 70s at this point, and she gave me a half-eaten box of cereal. I was probably about 12 years old. And then she told me that she had bought it for my cousin, who was about 7, and she didn't like it, so she gave it to me instead. She gave my mom she had this big dresser full of table linens, and she gave her a just ratty old tablecloth from the dresser that had stains and cigarette burns in it. She gave my aunt, my mom's sister, and her daughter a pair of those legs pantyhose that come in the egg, and then went on to tell her that she had bought them for the neighbor, but they were too big for her. And then she gave my sister this just gorgeous ball gown that she had had for decades and she had worn to galas when she was younger and that my aunt had always just adored and wanted.
What did you think when you got all that stuff?
I was pretty young. I was just really kind of confused. I think my aunt was really hurt, and everyone else was just kind of floored. My grandmother always been a little bit eccentric. I mean, she grew up during the Depression, but it was pretty surreal.
You wrote us on Facebook about just sort of like the memory of this, and it sounds like from your voice that this has morphed from weird gift to kind of like eccentric but wonderful memory.
Yeah, totally. I don't remember any other gift she ever gave me, that's for sure.
Sarah Hull, thank you so much for your time.
Sure thing.
Looking ahead from the holidays to the new year, we want to know, have you ever made a New Year's resolution about money that actually worked? Like you really went to the gym that you paid for, you got rid of that debt. Tell us how at MarketplaceWeekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. Watch or listen to business news, you know, a lot of jargon gets tossed around. Sometimes investors refer to industries as spaces for reasons that baffle me. They also use the terms long and short. Long as in betting on something and short as in betting against it. And this is the regular segment where we do that with news stories. And this week, we've got Marketplace's own senior editor, Patty Hirsch, who also hosts our Whiteboard Explainer series, and The Atlantic's senior associate editor, Jillian White. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Jillian's an old hand. So, Patty, I am going to let you give us your first long.
My first long is virtual reality. Okay.
Okay.
I was so underwhelmed by virtual reality initially. I got the Google Cardboard box. I downloaded the apps. I was playing around with it. I thought it was so naff and lame. But this last week, I gave it to my 9-year-old and 6-year-old nieces and my 3-year-old nephew to play with. And they went absolutely bananas for this stuff. I mean, they were so into it, they even stopped watching the Disney Channel. I mean, it beat Barbie. I mean, that's how big this thing is, I think. So I think these kids are so into it that I haven't gotten it. They love it. So I'm in it for the long term.
All right. Oh, okay. Fine. Jillian, you sound so skeptical.
I'm not even skeptical. I'm just profoundly uncool. Like, I can't even imagine the uses for that in my life or how it would manifest. So absolutely, 9 and 10-year-olds should totally do it.
There's no real use. I mean, you're walking around with this thing clamped to your head. You look like an idiot. But they don't care. They're 9 years old. They love
this
it.
This is true. All right. I know this is a slight shift in tone, but Jillian, give me your long.
Oh, man, a slight shift.
Yeah.
I'm going to be Debbie Downer during the holiday season, and my long is labor and supply chain reform and the conversation around it.
Dear, the Grinch.
If you're watching the news at all this week, AP released an investigation about shrimp peelers in Thailand, and it was really depressing. They found instances of human slavery, child labor, and a slew of other labor violations, and a lot of those shrimp landed in the U.S. in stores such as Walmart, Kroger, Whole Foods, Petco, Red Lobster, and Olive Garden.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, post Rana Plaza, there were questions in Bangladesh. There were questions about whether the companies on the end of the supply chain were going to take meaningful steps toward reform. Do you think we see that going forward?
So actually, NYU just released a report about that, Bangladesh specifically, and they found that the answer is largely no, because a lot of brands don't even know what those informal factories are at the end of their supply chain. They had vastly underestimated how many factories were in Bangladesh. I think that's just a call for consumers to be very educated and to really push for transparency, and not just transparency from companies about what they currently know about, but also push them to, go a step further. This is going to be incremental change.
All right, Jillian, I'm going to let you pivot us then and take me to your short because, I don't know, more upbeat?
Yes, it is more upbeat, or perhaps grinchier. So I am short a New Year's Eve, specifically New Year's Eve packages. An example for you guys. So to spend four glorious hours at the TGI Fridays in Times Square watching the ball drop, you would have to pay $200 per person, minimum.
What?
Wow.
Or if you're feeling really fancy at that TGI Fridays, you could buy the $900 couples VIP champagne package.
Ooh, dear.
I am going to stay in my apartment and never leave the house, clearly.
Exactly. So I feel like revelry is fine. People should absolutely have a good night, but it just feels like things have gotten a bit out of hand. Let's all dial it back, folks.
Absolutely. I'm with you. But I've been short New Year since the millennium, I think.
All right. You're on the out-of-hand train, Patty. Take it away.
Well, I'm going to be controversial here. I'm going to go on a limb. I am short Star Wars.
Oof.
Yep. Sorry.
So disappointed in you.
Well, what do you mean? This is an obvious short, right? This is like Star Wars to me right now looks like one of these classic tech IPOs during the bubble. Like everybody's talking about, oh my God, this thing is going to be huge. It's going to be enormous. It's going to pop like crazy. So we'll see this great pop over the weekend, you know, over Saturday and Sunday as people go to the movie and the box office numbers will be great and everyone's going to be rapturous. And then this thing is going to fall off a cliff.
I'm a child of Star Wars. I don't know if I can agree with you there. But also, I will say, the brilliance of pre-selling tickets is maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe you end run some of this stuff.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the long tail here. I mean, you know, the original Star Wars, the sort of, you know, the Princess Leia with the kung fu grip, whatever. I mean, that thing, those special edition dolls and what have you and all the merch that they had, that stuff is worth a lot of money now. We're not going to have a replication of that this time. The special edition is 20,000 pieces, right? And then you've got three of these movies that are going to be starring Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher. I mean, how good, I mean, with the greatest respect to them, how good is that third movie going to be? I mean, Harrison Ford might not even be alive by the time they make the third movie.
Stop speaking now, Patty.
It could take them 20 years to make these things.
I mean, I am with Patty that I think everyone who is desperate to see it bought pre-sale. I think you'll get a couple more people over the holiday. And then I think people kind of won't care.
Mm-hmm. Heresy. Heresy to you both. Jillian White from The Atlantic, Patty Hirsch from Marketplace. Thank you both very much.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks so much.
Now, I'm going to ask you for a little help. Marketplace Weekend is supported by listeners. And to help us keep telling relevant and interesting stories, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, counts twice as much right now, thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from the Candida Fund. Please donate at marketplace.org by December 31st, and thank you very much. It is, without question, the most important institution in America when it comes to our money. But let's be honest, do you actually know what the Federal Reserve does?
Nothing. For me. Besides hold all the government's money.
I have no clue.
They manage our money.
Federal Reserve, don't they kind of like monitor the money and for like inflation, et cetera, and so forth, and make sure that the economy, I guess, doesn't crash or something.
In my knowledge, they keep our money in a safe place, somewhere down in some mountains that can be penetrated by either nuclear bombs or people that want to take our money.
The Federal Reserve is the monetary system of the government. It's a banking system. It's the bank to the banks, really.
I'm gonna go with money, something.
The Federal Reserve, I feel like they take from society. They hold all the money.
Federal Reserve, it's the bank, National Bank of America. They do, and they issue the money. They, you know, print the notes, but it's not free.
The Federal Reserve is a non-government entity, isn't it? That makes recommendations to the government? I don't know. I'm not certain.
Well, the Federal Reserve right now
just lowered the interest rate. But it also sets monetary policy for the U.S.
That was Edgar Alvarez, Martha Quesada, Eva Mitnick, Nicole Hashem, George Flores, Rufus Washington, Nadia Mitnick, Ivan Adamsil, George Imrod, Sheila McPherson, and Enrique Gasca. Those explanations aren't too far off. And remember how at the top of the show I talked about the Federal Reserve in terms of give and take, give the economy a little gas, then hit the brakes, etc.? That was, of course, a simplistic version, because this week's quarter point interest rate raise from the Fed is more complicated than what the central bank would have done even a decade ago. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has this explanation of how exactly all of this works.
So imagine for a second all the money flying around the economy right now. Maybe it's payday at Google. Maybe Kim Kardashian just bought a handbag with her debit card. If you're a bank, you can't be caught with your pants down. You have to be ready for this by having some quick cash set aside.
Banks had to meet a level of required reserve.
Krista Schwartz teaches at Wharton. Banks keep this extra cash at the Fed. They have to by law. And in the olden days, 10 years ago, sometimes banks didn't have quite enough quick cash, or sometimes they had too much. So they'd help each other out.
They would borrow and lend to one another based on, you know, the inflows and outflows to their own accounts on each given day.
And they'd charge each other interest. This interest rate was the minimum basic interest rate in the whole economy. And it is this interest rate and this system of quick cash for banks that the Fed could control. It could suck cash out of this fast cash system, or it could inject cash in.
Supply and demand really was how they moved the rate higher and lower.
Now, here's the problem. During the recession, the Fed pumped so much cash into the bank's quick cash system that banks don't need quick cash now, no matter how many handbags Kim Kardashian buys.
These banks are completely awash in trillions of dollars worth of excess reserves, so nobody needs to borrow anything.
And if for some reason they do borrow or lend to each other, the interest rate would be pretty much zero. So, what can the Fed do now to raise rates when their tool is broken?
Now, it's a different game. It all works differently.
Joe Gagnon is with the Peterson Institute.
This time, what they're going to do is they're going to pay banks more interest on the reserves they own.
Yes, he said the Fed is going to pay banks. It will pay them interest on all that cash they've hoarded in their accounts at the Fed. Now, why would they do this? Well, because
banks won't lend for less than that, hopefully.
If a bank can earn good interest by keeping their cash safely at the Fed, they're not going to lend to anyone else for less than that amount.
And that will raise all other interest rates.
The Fed is going to do this with more than just banks. It's going to offer short-term investments to some other big institutions like mutual funds and insurance companies or Freddie and Fannie, so they can also earn money from the Fed. How, you might ask, can the Fed afford to pay out all this money?
They have assets. Those are the treasury bonds and mortgage bonds that they bought.
They bought trillions worth of these assets during the recession. And all those assets are paying interest. The Fed can use that to pay banks and other institutions.
So they have a long way to go before they would be paying more interest than they're earning.
Also, it's the Fed, so they can just create money if they wanted to. But the bottom line is that the Fed is trying to offer the minimum safest rate in the economy. And ideally, nobody will lend for less than that. How well these new tools work, we'll find out. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
That's how the Fed's interest rate increase will ripple through the monetary system. Now we want to talk about how this will affect you. Because it will, even if it doesn't happen overnight. And to do that, we have personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
Somebody I know put this to me and said, really, should a regular person care about a 0.25% interest rate raise? And I said, yes!
Because when you say interest rates, people's eyes just glaze over. It really is just, it's like a buzzkill right there. But it is probably the most important thing that touches each and every one of us. Because basically, every American consumer is probably either a saver or a borrower, or maybe both. And as a result, the what the Federal Reserve does and where interest rates go affects all of us.
I want to throw some things at you that we got as part of a Twitter chat that Kai did earlier in the week. One of them was from a couple looking to buy their first home, and they were wondering, you know, how much of an impact this is going to have on mortgage rates, which is, I think, the thing most people worry about.
Well, I think that what you should know is that short-term interest rates, those are the rates that the Fed controls, that's not exactly what determines a mortgage rate. Usually a mortgage keys off of a 10-year Treasury bond. And so far, those bond rates have stayed pretty stable. So right now, you can get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for about 4%. And even after the Fed decision, things didn't move around too much. And there's a big but that's coming. Mm-hmm. You ready for the but?
Go.
All interest rates are going to be rising over the next few years. I don't know by how much, okay? And I can't tell you that your 4% mortgage is going to be 4.25% next year or 4.5%. But what I can tell you is the direction is higher over the next few years. So if you're buying your first home and you're looking, I don't think you should feel the pressure of, oh my God, I should do this right this second. But I do think that if you were thinking of buying a home in the next year or so, go ahead and do it. If you were sort of laying back and saying, maybe 3 years, maybe 2 years, maybe next year, I might accelerate that to next year if you can afford it and it works for your family.
What about other kinds of debt that are more variable, things that have higher interest rates, like credit cards or student loans? You know, pay those off, refinance. What do you do?
Well, I know this sounds sick because credit card interest rates are so high. They probably could go up. And what's going to happen is the low end will probably rise. So if you're seeing the 9.9% rate, you may see a 11.9% rate or a 10.9% rate. The balance transfer lure that you might have gotten at a very good rate might be slightly higher. Again, we've only gone up by 0.25%. So none of this is drastic. It really isn't. We're just talking that over the next few years, all interest rates are likely to rise. They may not be huge. They might change depending on for how long you're borrowing. But the cost of a credit card, an auto loan, not as much of a student loan right this second. You know, the federal government does key on that rate. And, you know, I guess private loans could rise. But the government is probably going to hold the line for a little while on those rates.
We got one bigger picture question that I was interested in, and actually we sort of got it from two different people, different flavors, saying, you know, inflation's pretty much non-existent, wages and salaries not going up for a lot of people, and job growth is still not that hot, which had two different people ask, why did they do this at all?
That's a great question because, you know, there's no one who is going to argue that the U.S. economy is on fire and rocking and rolling and that the Fed really needs to get moving on this. However, 0 to 0.25%, which is where we've been for, we were for 7 years, was really the emergency room level of rates. And if we go back to December of 2008, which was when the Fed cut rates to this level, you see a dramatic difference. So December 2008, 7.2% unemployment rate, heading up to 10. So it was on the rise. A job loss of 680,000 in the month of December of 2008. And on top of that, we had the economy contracting. We were in a recession. It was contracting at an annualized pace of over 8%.
Okay. Wow.
That's intense, right? That's like, okay, we're in the emergency room. I get that, right? If you look at today, 7 years later, I can't tell you that it's a great economy, but 2.25% annualized pace for the last few years, a decent growth rate, not awesome. The economy's creating 200,000, 210,000 jobs a month right now this year. We are not seeing great wage growth. I think that's a valid concern, and there isn't a lot of inflation, but I think the Fed had to start somewhere. I don't think that the patient is in the emergency room anymore. I think this is the Fed's attempt to get the patient out of the hospital.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. As always, thank you.
Thank you. That Fed news was the big story here this week, but overseas, migrants are still trying to find their way into Europe. The International Organization for Migration says nearly 1 million people have entered Europe this year. Most are fleeing the Syrian war. And this is a different kind of story of give and take. The UK has agreed to take 20,000 migrants. Some have already arrived. Many are in the northern English city of Bradford. Our European correspondent Stephen Beard is in Bradford talking to some of those migrants to see how they're doing. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Lizzie.
Tell me a little bit about Bradford.
It's one of the great industrial cities of the north of England, or I should say one of the former great industrial cities. It was at its prime in the 19th century. What marks it out today is its ethnic diversity. It is the most diverse city in Britain. 20% of the population of about 500,000 here are of Pakistani origin or descent. That's the largest such percentage of any city in England. It is, to quite a large extent, a Muslim city.
Well, you've been speaking to some of the refugees. How do they feel about where they are now? And, you know, are they relieved?
Well, there's a total of about 250 Syrians living here now. And I should point out I've only spoken to about half a dozen of them so far. But they all express their gratitude to Britain for taking them in. But they also all express some dismay that Britain is, in their words, only taking in 20,000 Syrian refugees over the next 5 years.
They've got a lot of adjusting to do. You know, maybe work to find, lots of barriers to overcome. What sort of hurdles are they finding?
Well, the biggest, I think, by far, is language. Many of them do speak at least a little bit of English, but none that I've spoken to be frank, is really proficient yet. Some have actually complained about being sent to a multicultural city like Bradford, where you don't always hear English in the streets. But that's not Aham's complaint. He loves the city.
When I came to this city for the first week, I think I am not in the England in the beginning, because a lot of the people is not originally is English. Some of them is Pakistan, some of them is Arab, some of them is from China, Japan, different culture. And I like this city much better for this different culture. Why? Because now I am a Muslim. So I found a lot of the halal restaurant, a lot of the halal supermarket. So I found this city is the best city for the Syrian. I didn't found any much difference between this city and, for example, Cairo in Egypt.
Except for the weather, of course. The amazing diversity of the British weather has shocked some of the refugees. One of them told me, I never thought it was possible to have sunshine, rain and snow all on the same day.
So a lot of them are, you know, being resettled straight from camps, they may have walked away from everything. How much support, monetary and otherwise, are they getting from the UK government?
Well, quite a lot. Under the Vulnerable Persons Relocation Scheme, it's called, the refugees get 5 years of support. They get access to affordable housing, healthcare and education, and they can claim quite a wide range of benefits. All of the refugees I've spoken to, however, are very eager to work, but the language barrier is a problem. And for some, like 31-year-old Dr. Bashir Farhat, who was a hospital paediatrician in Syria, it's going to take a very long time mastering English and setting fresh medical exams to qualify to practice his old profession here. And Bashir is feeling an acute sense of loss of status.
Yeah, it's really difficult to move from the hospital where I used to work, to be a job seeker here and to wait for benefits. And yeah, it's really difficult to start from zero. This zero is quite far.
That's the way it feels, does it? Zero?
Yeah, I feel zero, yeah.
And he says he's torn between feeling useless here in Bradford while watching his country being torn apart from afar.
Well, that raises the question, does he want to go home?
Well, not yet. Some of them are incredibly homesick. I mean, some of those, particularly those that are on their own, separated from family and friends, are feeling quite lonely. There was one man I spoke to who's bought a cockatiel to keep him company. He's called it Shriek, not because that's the noise it makes, although it does. It's because Shariq in Arabic means partner. A sort of rather poignant reflection on his sense of isolation. But everyone I've spoken to here, including Aham Al-Halabi, says yes, when the war is over, they want to go home.
The refugees have to go through extensive screening, and now, of course, this question of are they associated with terrorists has come up. How do they feel about that process?
Well, it's obviously a pretty sensitive issue, yeah. This. I've only spoken to half a dozen, as I say, and they all accepted the need for some kind of vetting, but they all angrily rejected the notion that all Syrian refugees should be automatically barred because they might be ISIS terrorists. Many of these people are fleeing terrorism, which, incidentally, they say is not only what ISIS is doing. They argue President Assad is terrorizing his own people, too.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in Bradford. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Our stories are often dominated by numbers. It's kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day on marketplace.org. Here are producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
750.
It's an old story by now. That was the price Turig Pharmaceutical CEO Martin Shkreli set for the drug Daraprim. It used to cost only $13.50 per pill. The move threw him into the spotlight as the most hated man in America.
He stayed there this month when he paid millions for a one-of-a-kind Wu-Tang Clan album he said he might not even listen to.
His pretty insane story perhaps ended Thursday when Shkreli was arrested on fraud charges in Manhattan.
The feds say he hid losses and misused money from his companies and hedge funds for years.
$29 million.
That's potential loss to the L.A. Unified School District for canceling school Tuesday.
More than 600,000 students were told to stay away from 900 schools after the district got a hoax terror threat.
State officials say the district probably won't end up losing all that money, however.
22,000!
That's how many remote control robots Sphero sold in 12 hours.
The company ended up raking in 90% of its annual revenue in September alone, according to Bloomberg.
So what makes these little robots so great, Tony?
Well, they look just like BB-8, the adorable little droid from Star Wars The Force Awakens. It's coming out this weekend. I'm so excited.
Oh, dude, there's this really, really cool scene where BB-8 comes out
Raghu,
with his like, gigantic
gun. I thought I told you last time. No. No spoilers. I haven't seen it yet. You did this last time with Transformers 4.
Each week on the show, we highlight a story you bring us, whatever the big money story is where you live. We call it local money. And this week, we got a tweet from Ryan Underwood, who wanted to know how Vanderbilt University's land use plan deals with the city of Nashville, which is booming all around it. Vanderbilt is like a lot of universities around the country in that it's also a pretty big property owner. We called up Eric Kopstein, who is Vanderbilt's vice chancellor for administration. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
First off, what is this land use plan that you guys are doing right now?
Generally speaking, when I think about a campus land use plan, I'll think about the 330 acres or so of land that comprise the main campus of Vanderbilt University. However, Nashville is booming. There is construction every place. There are 20 cranes up at any given time, 30 hotels under construction, 75 to 100 people moving to Nashville every single day. And an important dimension of this land use plan that we're undertaking now is to have Vanderbilt not remain insular and try to ignore all of these economic developments going on, really, frankly, right around the border of our campus and beyond. So part of the challenge and the interest of this land use study is to figure out Vanderbilt's place in this rapidly developing city of Nashville.
Well, this is a local story someone brought to our attention, but at the same time, this is sort of a national thing that's happening. Columbia, here in New York, where I am, owns a tremendous amount of land in the city. Are you guys buying land?
Yes, we have been buying certain what I would refer to as strategic parcels that are generally adjacent to or very near our campus so that we can reserve those parcels for potential future development, but also create a little bit of a buffer between the main campus and some of the development going on all around us. And with the market booming right now, certain things that haven't traded for years and years are now available, and we are taking a somewhat more aggressive but strategic stance on this, where things that are nearby are always of interest, and every single day something is coming up, and every single day we are thinking about whether we should be pursuing an additional acquisition. But these typically come in parcels of a quarter acre, half acre, because we are an urban campus and there's not a lot of open land surrounding the area.
Do you know how much money you're spending?
I do, yeah. And I don't know if I want to give you a specific figure, but, you know, we've done deal. We bought a quarter acre of property that was adjacent to other parcels that we've assembled. And we had to pay over $2.5 million by way of example. That was north of $300 per square foot for that dirt. And dirt in the Nashville area is anywhere between, say, these days $150 to $300, or in some cases far north of there, depending on the specific locations.
I was amazed. We looked at numbers that say in the next sort of assessment, home prices in Nashville are supposed to go up 33 to 37%. I mean, the market there is going gangbusters.
It's unbelievable. And I think the city as a whole is becoming more and more dense. In my neighborhood, lovely 2,500 square foot homes on half acre parcels of land are routinely being bought up, knocked down, and replaced with two 3,000 to 4,000 square foot luxury homes. And the developers are making a lot of money off of this. But people are snapping up these homes left and right. And it's becoming, you know, it's really becoming a dialogue about what is Nashville becoming? Is it losing its character as it, if you will, redevelops in this way?
Eric Kopstein is the Vice Chancellor for Administration at Vanderbilt University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Come tell us what's the most important economic story where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. And he's also the host of Codebreaker, our new podcast that tries to answer this question. Is it evil? Ben, this week you are talking about virality on the internet, the very lifeblood of the internet, you could say. Like, I mean, that's what makes it go if something's viral.
Yeah.
But this is not always a happy, shiny, positive thing.
No, it is not, Lizzie. Something like the video David After Dentist. You know that one?
I don't. What is that?
Oh, if you haven't seen it, it's this kid basically warped out of his mind after visiting the dentist. And he says some like hilarious stuff and does some like really funny stuff. And his dad tapes him. It's a great video. Suggest you watch it if you need a laugh sometime. But of course, even that happy, just sort of funny, silly video raises questions.
Yeah.
When that kid David grows up, will he be comfortable with that material being on the internet, with being internet famous? Virality is absolutely a double-edged sword. It can make you famous, it can make you money, but it can also bring some unwanted attention and new social challenges, right?
Yeah.
It can change your life really fast. And we spoke to one kid, his name is Brendan Jordan, who ended up going viral after performing Lady Gaga-inspired dancing in the background of this live news broadcast near Las Vegas at a new mall that was opening up. And I'll let him explain the story.
The news people were there and I saw them and I was like, oh my God, I should go over there and try to get interviewed and maybe I can just get my little camera time, you know, because who doesn't want a little bit of camera time and in the spotlight? And then so they just turned on the cameras. They did their little live thing and did my thing. Of course, I think you guys have probably seen it. And I mean, I never saw the actual news story on it because I think it was live at the time and they didn't replay it later that night. So I never got to see it. And then I went to sleep and it only took a day. Then one local news station after another started picking up, then went from locally to internationally. After I kind of went viral, it opened me up to new things that I've never really heard about. And, you know, how I do feel inside, I guess, would correspond with the gender fluid label, where I accept both he and she, male and female pronouns, because that's just something that I'm comfortable with at the time. And that's how I feel right now, because I just like the limitless feeling of it.
So Brendan's story is kind of complicated, right? He started getting attention about his sexual identity after his dance moves. And as we know, the internet can be kind of a rough, mean place when it comes to harassment and sexual identity. And this has actually been a challenge for him at school. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Trying to figure out which bathroom to use. And the schools that he's been to don't necessarily have policies about that or trying to figure that out. And he's in the limelight all this time on YouTube. And that's complicated.
And this changed not only his life. Tell me about that.
So one thing a lot of us can forget about being users online is that some of this stuff can actually change the lives of the people around us, right?
None of this is in a vacuum.
None of this is in a vacuum. And so we also talked with Brendan's mom about how much his life and their life had changed because of this video going viral.
We go out in public and everywhere we go, I mean, it's not a mass mob, but everywhere we go in Las Vegas, or especially Los Angeles for some reason, not even our hometown, we get stopped for pictures and everything. And, you know, of course, as a mom, you worry about your kids coming in contact with strangers anyway. And then
sure,
you have all these people. And I'm grateful for all the support. Trust me, I am grateful. But I think my number one fear is this security for him, you know, being taken advantage of or something worse.
One of the biggest things about going viral online is this idea also, Lizzie, that once it happens, you can't really easily go back.
Right.
From
that's not
it,
a bell,
right?
That can be unrung.
Right. And when you're a kid, that's even more complicated, right? And as you grow older, maybe you're thinking about these things in a more nuanced way than you might think as a kid. I mean, Brendan's obviously a really, really smart, nuanced, thoughtful kid about this stuff, but maybe his feelings on it will change at some point. And especially when it comes to individuals or groups that are marginalized in the real world, that can be increased tenfold. The internet can either be a powerful tool for finding a supportive community if you're a user who has, you know, certain interests, but it can also be a place where you're opening up yourself to harassment or scrutiny that you didn't necessarily invite.
Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech and Codebreaker, and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
It seems like almost every business of any kind has been made into a reality show. Storage, restaurants, fishing, bridal boutiques. And many of the shows based on those businesses have done incredibly well, except art. Two art world reality shows have failed to make it. And now there's this.
Hi.
Hi.
Is that Blake Little?
Yeah, perfect, he dumped 10 gallons of honey on each of his models.
That's a lot.
He is the most cutting edge. He is hot right now.
He's super hot.
That's a clip from Art Breakers, which runs on Ovation, an independent media company whose slogan is Art Everywhere. It's the latest attempt to make a reality hit based on the art business. And to figure out why that hasn't really worked before, we brought in Michael H. Miller. He's a senior editor for Art News, and he's written about all this. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a sense of what Art Breakers is about. I feel like I've seen some previews here, so what's it like?
Well, it's about art advisors, and it focuses on two young women, and they're mostly based in Los Angeles, and the show follows their exploits in the art world. It's four episodes long, mercifully.
You said mercifully, which makes me think that perhaps this is not the most accurate reflection of the art world?
No, it's not. It presents everything in the art world as sort of above board, which is just not the case.
There have been a couple attempts to try to make reality shows out of the art business, and they haven't really worked.
Mm.
And then Sony's streaming division is bringing a scripted show about the art world. Why do you think there has been both this interest and yet sort of a disconnect in making a successful show out of it?
The big thing about the art world, and I think one of the reasons why a reality TV show about it hasn't really worked yet, is that the whole business sort of lacks transparency by design. People don't really like to talk about how the sausage gets made. So just for one example of its kind of closed offness, you know, New York has a truth in pricing law, which states that items for sale in a commercial space have to be conspicuously displayed. And I have never, in the many years that I've covered the art world, walked into a gallery and seen price tags for works that are on view that are for sale. What usually happens is there's a checklist that you have to ask someone at the front desk for. But even then, those usually don't have prices on them. It's usually just a title and dimensions and the year it was completed. So then you can ask a gallery employee if you're so inclined, but oftentimes the gallery employee won't disclose price. So, I mean, that's just one example. That's a very easy thing, displaying prices for works that are for sale that just doesn't go on at commercial galleries in New York.
Which makes it, in so many ways, seemingly unlike a lot of other markets. I mean, you know, price is such a key thing for just about everything that's bought and sold.
Right. The line that people use about the art world is that it's sort of the largest unregulated economy that there is, which is not completely true because there is some regulation, but there is very little oversight. So there's nobody going around and policing the fact that galleries aren't displaying their prices. And more to the point, that lack of transparency leads to certain ethically dubious business decisions. The art economy is very robust right now, and it continues to grow. And, you know, as a result of that, you have a lot of speculative collectors who are manipulating and exploiting artists, especially younger artists. There's a young artist named Lucian Smith, a painter, and he, a few years ago, right out of school, started to gain the attention of certain speculative collectors who were working in collusion with dealers to purchase work by him in bulk at very low prices because he had just graduated from school. Nobody had heard of him. And so they then turned around almost immediately and resold this work at a great profit. And suddenly there were works by Lucian Smith everywhere, and he was this household name, and the works kept getting bought and resold at more and more profit. And then eventually the demand for the work just collapsed and the market collapsed with it. And this young artist is sort of left with no market and nobody is interested in buying the work anymore. And that's the kind of thing, that's one example, but that's the kind of thing that goes on all the time, which is completely absent from a show like Art Breakers or any other attempt at televising the art business.
So if you, Michael H. Miller, were to concoct your own show about the art world, reality or scripted, what would you show?
I would personally watch a hagiography of Larry Gagosian. Like, they wouldn't even have to show any kind of like shadowy backdoor things.
And if you're listening to this and you have no idea who that is, explain for us.
Well, Larry Gagosian is, by all rights, the most powerful art dealer in the world. And you know, the number of galleries he owns keeps going up, but I think right now the count is 16.
Wow.
5 years ago it was 11, which seemed like a lot. And, you know, he has galleries on five continents, so.
So he's a mogul.
Yeah, he's an actual mogul, a sort of robber baron kind of figure.
Michael H. Miller is the senior editor for Art News. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for the week. For the future, we want to know, did you make a New Year's resolution that you actually kept? And if so, how'd you do it? Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114, and your voice might be on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Raghu Manavalan. Patty Hirsch was our senior producer this week, and Chris Clark was our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Jebra Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.